Welcome to the show. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I was talking last week, not too coherently. I guess I was trying to say, well, here we are supposedly an advanced civilization and not as advanced as maybe other civilizations out there in the universe, if there's any. We have technology and sometimes we have problems with that technology. And I was having problems with my recorder and I'm couldn't figure it out, and when I went to the memory it was full, so that was a simple solution to it. And I never thought of that. I wasn't using my superior intellect. I don't know if I have much of it, but anyway, I think I deleted a few of the shows and I think I'm good to go. I was also talking maybe a month ago about global warming, and here we are, it's June the 15th or something like that, coming up the summer, and we have a cool spring, which is nice for me because I don't think anybody liked that summer of, or the June of last year where it was 45 or 50 degrees Celsius. So I prefer it like this, 16-17, I guess clouds, and the clouds sometimes interfere when you're an astronomer. I wanted to see planetary alignments, but even now, as I'm speaking in the afternoon, there's clouds in the sky. And there's the strawberry moon that was on June 14th, and I missed it. I saw the moon a few days before that, and I couldn't tell anything about it. But this one on the 14th, people apparently all over the world were raving about this strawberry moon. So I've heard about wolf moons and all kinds of other moons. So why is this strawberry moon? I think it's because harvesting... It coincides with the strawberry harvesting season in Europe and North America, and it arrived just a week before the summer solstice. So let me read about this a bit. Amazing photos of the strawberry supermoon of 2022 from around the world, published about 3 hours ago, which is today is the 15th, so it was published on the 15th. And it said the June full moon was one of the two largest full moons of 2022. And here's a beautiful photo, and somewhere in the desert, maybe in Arizona or Nevada. Mesmerizing views of one of the two largest full moons of 2022 thrilled stargazers all over the world yesterday night, June 14th, with stunning images arriving from astrophotographers in New York, Italy, America's Mojave Desert, and elsewhere. The June full moon, also dubbed the strawberry moon, as it coincides with the strawberry harvesting season in Europe and North America, arrived just a week before the summer solstice, illuminating the long warm evenings many in the northern hemisphere are now enjoying. So I've been watching, I do this quite a bit. I watch like Detroit News, New York News, Los Angeles News, Chicago News, and in Detroit it's pretty close to 100, and I think it's warm in New York too, not like here. This year's strawberry moon earns the supermoon designation as it occurs while Earth's natural satellite is near the closest point to Earth in its slightly elliptical orbit around the planet. In 2022, the June and July full moons qualify for the supermoon label, according to NASA. Eclipse scientist Fred Espenac, who also tracks supermoons, had said June's full moon was the second in a series of four back-to-back supermoons from May to August. So there's going to be a few more. This image shows the strawberry supermoon setting behind Trona Pinnacles in the Mojave Desert in California by photographer David McNew of Getty Images. These unique limestone spires, some up to 140 feet or 43 meters, formed in the ancient past when Mojave formed a bottom of a lake. For amateur astronomers hoping to photograph the moon, check out our best cameras for astrophotography and best lenses for some helpful tips. You can also read our guide on how to photograph the moon with a camera to make the most of your next lunar photo session. So I'm reading now from a website called space.com. Sometimes I read from Live Science, sometimes I read from nasa.gov, and this one at the top, it says, thank you for looking at our website. When you purchase something from us, then we get some commission, so please look at our..." So they do sell things for astronomers. And I guess that's what it's different about the other websites, is they sell astronomy products. It is just like typical Vancouver weather, where we don't see anything anymore, because even when it's not raining, because there's clouds out there. So I remember I was on Route 66 going from Las Vegas to Los Angeles one time, and I stopped the car and I looked at the beautiful Milky Way. It's the best view I've ever had of the Milky Way. I am envious of those people that live in like in Arizona, California, Nevada, probably New Mexico or maybe Utah, where they have a lot of clear skies and they can see all these beautiful astronomical sights. And of course, seeing the Milky Way is the most awe-inspiring thing that I've ever seen in astronomy. But I did once see from my backyard. I looked up and I looked at star maps and I thought, okay, I want to look for the, see, sometimes I'm stuck like this. I want to say something and I forget. The next closest galaxy to us, the big one, and that's about 2.5 times the size, and I saw it and it was amazing. I think it's called the Andromeda Galaxy. So I did spot it from my backyard, but in a dark area, but it was very awe-inspiring, just as the Milky Way was. So let's talk about China now, because China wanted to shoot down Elon Musk's satellites. So did China just detect signals from an alien civilization? By Leonard David, published right now. Probably not, experts say. So China has this big, China's 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope, or FAST. I think it's probably the biggest telescope in the world. So China's doing a lot of things in astronomy. The internet is abuzz with rumors that China may have picked up signals from an alien civilization. The news centers on observation by China's SkyEye, the 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope, FAST, or FAST, which is located in southwestern Guizhou province. One report by the state-backed Science and Technology Daily cited Zhang Tongjie, chief scientist of an extraterrestrial civilization search team co-founded by Beijing Normal University. Guess what? I actually worked at Beijing Normal University in China. Wow. When they say Beijing Normal, it means Teachers University. The National Astronomical Observatory of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and the University of California, Berkeley. Zhang is reported to have said the team spotted two sets of intriguing signals in 2020 while sifting through FAST data gathered in 2019. Another signal was apparently picked up this year in data gathered exoplanet targets. Now, I don't know if everybody would agree with me, but I think if we did have contact with an alien civilization, I think that would be the most amazing thing that's ever happened to us. And guess what? They could be hostile, but they could be helpful, and they could tell us, well, this is how you solve global warming, or something like that. However, Zhang reportedly also underscored the possibility that the signals are products of radio interference. Follow-up FAST observations are reportedly on tap. The Science and Technology Daily story has since been removed from the outlet site. To get some perspective about the FAST rumors, Inside Outer Space reached out to Dan Werthermer, the Marilyn and Watson Albert SETI chair in the astronomy department and space scientist lab at the University of California, Berkeley. He works with the Beijing Normal University SETI researchers. Werthermer threw cold water on the possibility that the FAST signals were produced by advanced aliens. So says Werthermer, and quote, sorry about that, "These signals are from radio interference. They are due to radio pollution from Earthlings, not from ET. The technical term we use is RFI, radio frequency interference. RFI can come from cell phones, TV transmitters, radar, satellites, as well as electronics and computers near the observatory that produce weak radio transmissions. All of the signals detected by SETI researchers so far are made by our own civilization, not another civilization. It's getting hard to do SETI observations from the surface of our planet. Radio pollution is getting worse as more and more transmitters and satellites are built. Some radio bands have become impossible to use for SETI, end quote. Werthermer said that Earthlings might eventually have to go to the far side of the moon to do SETI work. Well, that'd be interesting. A radio telescope on the backside of the moon would be shielded from all of our planet's radio pollution. Okay, so that was an interesting article. And let me tell you something about these things that we call interference. I did go, 3 or 4 years ago, I did go to the LIGO Observatory in Washington, and I had an interview there, and they were showing me how they try to build the observatory far from traffic, because when trucks were rumbling down the highway, they would make vibrations, and to expert astronomers or to just anybody listening to the signal, the truck rumblings could be confused for gravitational waves. So I'm wondering how they, so that's one of the questions I had there, was how do you shield things like interference, other things like truck rumblings, how do you shield that all from your signal you want to pick up, which is a gravitational wave? So here he was saying a lot of the transmitted stuff they pick up is just from us. It's called pollution, I guess, noise pollution, and we're used to seeing light pollution when we have our telescopes out and we live in a city. So I am going to go for a break now, and when we come back, we'll discuss more astronomy and see how our happy skies will help us see some things. But as I said, we are in an age where nearly everything that happens with the weather, they say, oh, this unpredictability, that's what global warming does. It can make it cold, make it hot, but then there's no real thing we can pin down and say, okay, that's caused by global warming. Rising global temperatures are here. Every year it seems the Earth gets hotter, so we can say, okay, that's one thing we could definitely pin down. We can say that is from global warming. But sometimes the people that tell us, oh, this is from global warming, it doesn't make sense, because if it's hot, cold, windy, dry, rainy, whatever, they'll say, oh, that's global warming, without real explanation or facts to back that. But as I said, rising global temperatures do tell us there is global warming. But there's also other things I've thought about, like ice ages and when the meteor strike or the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. There's a lot worse things have happened to Earth, and life has rebounded all the time. So is it really as bad as we say it is? Because I don't want people to get mad at me now and say, oh, you're denying there's global warming. No, I'm just saying that our Earth has been through a lot of things over its 4.5 billion year history, and we're still here. So hopefully we can also use the moon, like it said there, do SETI on the far side of the moon. Maybe the moon will help us out, because we can build something up there where people can live. So I'm going to go for a break. Thank you for listening. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Asha Talk on CITR 101.9. There is an article here on Live Science. Physicists link two-time crystals in seemingly impossible experiment. It could help bridge classical and quantum physics. We'll stay tuned for that, because that seems like a thing that scientists have been trying to do for a long time. So when I was on the space.com site, it wasn't very interesting. Nothing of the articles. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to livescience.com. There's a couple stories I want to cover. One is James Webb Telescope is hit by some kind of small particle. But first I'm going to go to this article. Weird type of fast radio burst discovered 3 billion light years away. This could be a sign that fast radio bursts have more than one cause. And this is published 6 days ago, so it's published on the 9th of June. Here's an artist illustration of a fast radio burst arriving at Earth. The frequencies contained within the burst have been separated or dispersed by passing through clouds of electrons. Cool stuff. Astronomers have used two of the world's largest radio telescopes to discover the second known example of a new type of fast radio burst, FRB, the mysterious, extremely powerful explosions of radio waves that pulse through space thousands of times a day. The new FRB, called FRB190520, is strong evidence that multiple celestial objects could be the source of these enigmatic signals. The new FRB called, the new object is a second detected that not only produces repeating fast radio bursts, but that also emits a constant source of weaker radiation in between eruptions. The signal was described in detail in June 8 paper published in the journal Nature. So when this makes me recall, I don't know why it makes me recall, I was reading something about the particles that move in between atoms, and they carry signals like bonding, gravitational, other things. And how do scientists come up with this stuff? It's just amazing how they figure this stuff out. First spotted in 2007, fast radio bursts discharge more energy in a few brief milliseconds than the sun does in a year. Astronomers have long puzzled over the source of these sudden bright flashes, but as they predominantly erupt from galaxies millions or even billions of light years away and flare quickly and often only once, it is very challenging to identify their sources. In 2020, the first ever detection of a fast radio burst within our own galaxy enabled scientists to trace its origin to a magnetar, a highly magnetized, fast-rotating husk of a dead star. Stars are a special type of neutron star, which are ultra-dense stellar corpses left behind from supernova explosions. Magnetars have unusually strong magnetic fields, trillions of times more powerful than that of Earth. But scientists aren't sure that all fast radio bursts come from magnetars. Even stranger, the flashes from some fast radio bursts repeat, sometimes in a single brief burst and other times across multiple sporadic iterations of these repeated fast radio bursts. The first and most active is FRB121102, located in a dwarf galaxy 3 billion light years away. The unknown source spits out radio waves from a compact region over a cycle of 157 days. It alternates between 90 days of powerful repeating radio bursts and 67 days of softer, weaker radio emissions. FRB121102 is highly active, having been recorded belching out 1,652 flares across a span of 47 days, and for a while astronomers thought it was the only one of its kind, until now. So what happens is we know we are the only form of life that we know about. Sometimes we take that for granted, but that's the most spectacular thing in the universe, even though we have a fast radio burst, where in a few brief milliseconds, it discharges more energy than the sun does in a year. So in astronomy, we have gigantic scales, and just the scale of 3 billion light years, that's a huge distance. We would never even get close to approaching that. And this amount of energy discharge, or fast radio burst, when it discharges more energy in a few brief milliseconds than our sun does in a year. So that's just spectacular. That's one of the things that amazes me about these things, is the scale of the distances, the energies, the velocities. We don't even get close to that. And I guess that's one of the things that amazes me. But of course, our existence is more amazing. The researchers caught their first glimpses of the new fast radio burst, FRB-190520, using China's 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope, FAST. FAST confirmed that the distant object was emitting frequent and repeating radio bursts, and later observations made with New Mexico's Very Large Array, VLA, pinpointed its location. Scientists found that the repeating burst source, much like its cousin, was situated in a dwarf galaxy roughly 3 billion light years from Earth. The VLA also confirmed that the source of FRB-190520 was small and compact, and that it was leaking weaker radio emissions in between bigger flashes. The arrival of a second fast radio burst with similar behavior to the first raises some important questions and strengthens the possibility that there could be two different types of fast radio bursts, the scientists say. So says study co-author Kishitij Agarwal, and quote, "Are those that repeat different from those that don't? What about the persistent radio emission? Is that common?" End quote. So this professor, our co-author, is Kishitij Agarwal, an astronomer and graduate student at West Virginia's University. The astronomers believe that either two or more completely different mechanisms exist to produce these stunning cosmic flashes, or the bursts are being made by objects at very different stages of their cosmic evolution. Some indirect evidence supports the second hypothesis. So they're made by objects at very different stages of their cosmic evolution. As FRBs often arrive as single pulses from an unknown origin, astronomers usually estimate how far the source is from Earth by measuring how much an FRB's emitted radio waves are separated by frequency, like light after it's passed through a prism, something that happens to them the more often they encounter free electrons in space. Called dispersion, the effect offers astronomers a good rough guess of how far a radio flash has traveled before it reaches telescopes on Earth, assuming that electrons are fairly evenly distributed in space. The arrival of a second fast radio burst with similar behavior of the first raises some important questions and strengthens the possibility that there could be two different types of fast radio bursts, the scientist says. So says Professor grad student Agarwal, and quote, "Are those that repeat different from those that don't? What about the persistent radio emission? Is that common?" End quote. Astronomers believe that either two or more completely different mechanisms exist to produce these stunning cosmic flashes, or the bursts are being made by objects at very different stages of their cosmic evolution. Some indirect evidence supports the second hypothesis. As fast radio bursts often arrive as a single pulse from an unknown origin, astronomers usually estimate how far the source is from Earth by measuring how much an FRB's emitted radio waves are separated out by frequency, like light after it's passing through a prism, something that happens to them the more often they encounter free electrons in space. I'm sorry if I'm reading this again, I lost my place. Called dispersion, the effect offers astronomers a good rough guess of how far a fast radio burst has traveled before it reaches telescopes on Earth, assuming the electrons are fairly evenly distributed in space. So I would think there's not many electrons in free space, or free electrons in space. but being able to trace the location of fast radio bursts, 1950-20 source revealed a strange mismatch. The radio waves from the pulsing object were dispersed enough to have come from something 8 billion to 9.5 billion light years away. But by studying the Doppler shift, or the stretching out of the radio waves wavelength caused by the universe's expansion, the astronomers more accurately placed the object at just under 3 billion light years from Earth. So says Agarwal again, and quote, "This means that there is a lot of material near the fast radio burst that could confuse any attempt to use it to measure the gas between galaxies. If that's the case with others, then we can't count on using fast radio bursts as cosmic yardsticks," end quote. So isn't this amazing that all these wonderful things are happening in outer space when you think, well, why should something happen in the first place? But anyway, they're happening. Fast radio bursts, gravitational waves, stars colliding, supernovas, lots of other things, galaxies merging, and it's one of the beautiful things about being an astronomer. The unusually dense electron clouds around the fast radio burst could suggest the source is a newborn magnetar, still cloaked in the material of the supernova explosion that created it. But researchers will need many more measurements before they can be sure. The fast radio burst field is, moving very fast right now, and new discoveries are coming out monthly. However, big questions still remain, and this object has given us challenging clues about those questions. Okay, so I guess you could call that, I guess I could be safe to say maybe that's astrophysics, is it? Well, I think it is. Okay, now what I wanted to do, I'm on NASA's website, but I'm trying to find the story. That's the story I was looking for. I heard the James Webb Telescope was hit by a micrometeorite, and here it is. It says James Webb Space, so that was on the regular news on TV, so I guess that was a big enough story to broadcast it on TV. So it says James Webb Space Telescope hit by large micrometeorite. So if it's a large micrometeorite, can't you just call it, instead of saying large and then micro, why don't you just call it a meteoroid? Just like a jumbo shrimp. Okay, so here, James Webb Space Telescope hit by large micrometeoroid. I guess it's one of the nightmares that these James Webb Space Telescope scientists have, by Megan Bartel, published 6 days ago, which is the 9th of June. NASA says we can still expect pristine images on July 12th. NASA's Next Generation Space Observatory has sustained its first noticeable micrometeoroid impact less than 6 months after launch, but the agency isn't too concerned. The James Webb Space Telescope, also known as Webb or JWST, launched in December 25th, 2021. Oh, that reminds me. I think Hubble turns 32 now, so Hubble is getting close to middle age now. It has spent the intervening months trekking out to its deep space post and preparing for science observations, a complicated process that has gone through remarkably smoothly. Recently, NASA said it expects to unveil the first science quality images from the telescope on July 12th, which is about a month away. That sounds peachy. Now, the agency announced on Wednesday, June the 8th, that the observatory has experienced its first few impacts from tiny pieces of space debris called micrometeoroids. But don't panic, neither the observatory's schedule nor its scientific legacy is expected to suffer. So says Lee Feinberg, Webb Optical Telescope Element Manager at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and quote, "With Webb's mirrors exposed to space, we expected that occasional micrometeoroid impacts would gracefully degrade telescope performance over time. Since launch, we have had four smaller measurable micrometeorite strikes that were inconsistent with expectations, and this one more recently that is larger than our degradation predictions assumed," end quote. Here is a live update on NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, a link and related how James Webb Space Telescope works in pictures. The most serious of the impacts occurred between May 3rd and May 25th and affected the C3 segment of the 18-piece gold-plated hexagonal primary mirror. All spacecraft are expected to experience and designed to withstand micrometeoroid impacts, and JWST is no different. The observatory's engineers even subjected mirror samples to real impacts to understand how such event might affect the mission. So what I'm going to do now, there is a nice little video.
New machine for science. The James Webb Space Telescope is a complex collection of scientific instruments designed to tackle some of the biggest questions in astrophysics. Webb has four instruments contained within the Integrated Science Instrument Module, or ISIM, located directly behind the primary mirror. They are all designed to observe an infrared light, which is invisible to human eyes. Infrared is a longer wavelength of light located on the electromagnetic spectrum, just beyond light human eyes can see. We feel infrared light as heat. Each of the instruments play a different scientific role. The near-infrared camera, or NIRCam, is the main imaging system. NIRCam will look back in time to study the formation of the earliest stars and galaxies. One aspect of its design includes the ability to block light from a bright object, so much that a much dimmer object nearby might be observed. This means that in addition to looking at distant objects from the earliest days of the universe, scientists hope to study aspects of planets orbiting nearby stars. The NIRCam instrument also plays a key role in the process of aligning Webb's 18 primary mirrors, its secondary mirror, and its fine steering mirror using a clever technique called wavefront sensing and control. One of the best ways to find out new information about distant objects is through analysis of the light those objects emit. The near-infrared spectrograph, or NIRSpec, will collect spectral information about distant objects in order to determine their composition, temperature, velocities, and mass. To do this, NIRSpec will employ a unique technology called a micro-shutter array. It's an extraordinary collection of mechanical shutters, each barely wider than the thickness of a human hair, that can simultaneously collect high-resolution data from up to 100 distant objects. Different wavelengths of light present different information, and each of Webb's scientific instruments pursues different slices within the infrared spectrum. The mid-infrared instrument, or MIRI, will look at wavelengths of light that are a little longer than the other instruments will observe. Not only will this enable extraordinary images, but it will also allow scientists to search for planets around distant stars, dust warmed by starlight in protoplanetary disks, and comets and asteroids in our own solar neighborhood. MIRI is the coldest instrument on Webb, operating at just 6 degrees Celsius or 11 degrees Fahrenheit above absolute zero. The fourth part of Webb's instrument suite is two instruments. The near-infrared imager and slitless spectrograph, working in concert with the fine guidance sensor, will look for ancient light in the universe and information about planets around distant stars. The fine guidance sensor helps keep Webb pointed and perfectly steady during all observations. Together, these instruments and the technologies that will enable them will make up one of the most complex and ambitious undertakings in the history of humanity. This is NASA's James Webb Space Telescope.
Hi, welcome back. I don't know if you guys like these, but I love these little videos when you got some scientists like this and they are so knowledgeable and they explain things so well, and it brings it kind of, you can look behind just the headlines, which say, okay, this is Webb and this is what they study. Then they go down in depth and talk about things that's very interesting for myself. So I'm getting back to this micrometeor impact that hit Webb. The most serious of the impacts occurred between May 3rd and May 25th. Okay. However, the recent impact was larger than those mission personnel had modeled or could test on the ground. Despite the impact coming so early in the observatory's tenure, NASA officials are confident that the $10 billion space telescope will still perform adequately. Adequately. I hope it does more than adequately. So says Paul Geithner, technical deputy project manager at NASA Goddard. And quote, we always knew that Webb would have to weather the space environment, which includes harsh ultraviolet light and charged particles from the sun, cosmic rays from exotic sources in the galaxy, and occasional strikes by micrometeors within our solar system. We designed and built Webb with performance margin, optical, thermal, electrical, and mechanical, to ensure it can perform its ambitious science mission even after many years in space. End quote. In addition, JWST launched with its optics in even better shape than the agency bargained for, officials noted in the statement. Some micrometeor impacts can be predicted, officials wrote. For example, when the spacecraft is set to fly through known meteor showers, personnel can maneuver James Webb Space Telescope's optical systems into safety for these events. However, the recent impact was not part of such a meteor shower, and the statement classified it as an unavoidable chance event. After an impact occurs, engineers can individually adjust the 18 primary mirror segments on the observatory to keep the mirror as a whole finely tuned. So what do they do if a big enough rock comes up and bang, hits it in the middle, or hits one of its mirrors? We'll have to see. And the James Webb Space Telescope team continues to evaluate the impact. NASA is focused on better understanding both the particular event and the environment that the observatory will experience throughout its mission. The telescope is orbiting what scientists call the Earth-Sun Lagrange Point 2, located nearly 1 million miles or 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth in the direction opposite the Sun. So says Feinberg, and quote, we will use this flight data to update our analysis of performance over time and also develop operational approaches to assure we maximize the imaging performance of Webb to the best extent possible for many years to come. So that's the end of this article. And there's some links here. I'm just quickly looking over them. The scientific mysteries no other observatory could unravel, and James Webb Space Telescope, the engineer behind a first light machine that is not allowed to fail. So let's quickly look at this. James Webb Space Telescope, the scientific mysteries no other observatory can unravel. So here it shows a picture of an example, and it shows a picture from Hubble and then a picture from Webb. And Webb is, there's a galaxy field, and there's so many more galaxies that can be seen much clearer in Webb. When scientists planned and designed the Hubble Space Telescope, the most groundbreaking astronomical observatory of its era, there were many things about the universe they didn't know. One of these unknowns was that stars and galaxies existed already a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. Mark McCregan, Sr., advisor for science and exploration at the European Space Agency, told space.com. But even if they had known about these early stars and galaxies, they didn't have the technology to make Hubble see them. Hubble, so says McCaughrean, who is also an interdisciplinary scientist at NASA's James Webb Space Telescope Science Working Group, and quote, Hubble had a whole bunch of top-line goals, many of which were like 20 years old. By the time they built it, science had changed in some areas. And one of the things that astronomers discovered in the 1980s, shortly before Hubble's 1990 launch, was that galaxies formed much earlier than expected. It became obvious that another, even grander space observatory would be needed to get to those early stars and galaxies, those that had lit up the universe after hundreds of millions of years of darkness that followed the Big Bang, when the expanding space was only filled with hydrogen atoms. The technology that would eventually enable this observatory, now known as the James Webb Space Telescope, originally called the Next Generation Space Telescope, to see that mythical first light in the universe had yet to be developed. And I may have mentioned in another show, but there's a successor to Webb called WFIRST. I interviewed the guy a couple of years ago, and if you want to look on the website, I think it's somewhere there. But it seemed like when I talked to the guy, it almost had the same goals as Webb. Now here's a subtitle. It says, The Power of Infrared Eyes. This missing piece of technology was infrared detectors that would be able to collect the faint light coming from those early stars and galaxies more than 13 billion light years away. Hubble was built to detect visible and ultraviolet light. These early galaxies do emit visible light, but because of their distance, the wavelength of this light gets stretched into the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum by the so-called redshift. McCaughrean, then a PhD student at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, was one of the scientists developing early infrared detectors, a technology that has now reached in its culmination in four cutting-edge scientific instruments of the James Webb Space Telescope. So imagine you meet somebody and you ask, oh, what's your job? And they say, oh yeah, I develop early infrared detectors for the James Webb Space Telescope. Wow, you think, my gosh, that's amazing. So says McCaughrean again, and quote, in the 1980s, infrared pictures were taken with one detector scanning the sky one pixel at a time. It took forever. My PhD thesis was all about the first camera which could take 2D infrared images. We had 58 times 62 pixels, and that was 4,000 times more than everybody else had because they only had one, end quote. McCaughrean later moved to the U.S. to work on the near-infrared camera and multi-object spectrometer, NICMOS. NICMOS, the first infrared detector fitted on the Hubble Space Telescope during its second servicing mission in 1997. NICMOS, consisting of three infrared detectors, each of which had 256 by 256 pixels, opened the first door for Hubble into the infrared universe. That technology has come a long way since Hubble early years, and the James Webb Space Telescope project has been pushing it farther along the way. So says McCaughrean again, and quote, the detectors on James Webb Space Telescope have 2,000 by 2,000 pixels, and we have lots of them. Wow. We have many more infrared pixels on James Webb Space Telescope than Hubble had optical pixels when it was launched, end quote. Infrared pixels, wow. So what exactly will all those pixels, in combination with all the other aspects of the mission that make it so groundbreaking, enable James Webb's Space Telescope to do? The James Webb Space Telescope's giant mirror will feed the light of stars and galaxies into four cutting-edge instruments designed not only to take images, but also to analyze the chemical composition of the near and distant universe. This is done with a technique known as spectroscopy, which looks at how matter in the universe absorbs light. As different chemical elements absorb light at different wavelengths, astronomers will be able to reconstruct what stars, nebulas, galaxies, and planets within James Webb Space Telescope's sight are made of. The James Webb Space Telescope's instruments are a factor of 10 to 100 times better than anything previously available. In some of those mid-infrared wavelengths, there's probably an advantage of 1,000 for some kinds of observations. These improvements in the resolution of infrared imaging are critical for imaging the furthest reaches of the universe, where the Hubble Space Telescope, or the recently retired infrared telescope Spitzer, could provide only a rough estimate of an ancient galaxy's age and chemical composition. Webb will deliver with precision, added Kimball, who previously worked on instruments for the Hubble Space Telescope, including the Wide Field Camera 3, Hubble's most advanced instrument, which was installed during the final servicing mission in 2009. Here is an image they're showing of Spitzer. So Spitzer is NASA's previous infrared telescope. Spitzer was much smaller and therefore much less sensitive. So I'm going to go back to the top of this because I'm going to read the title of this article in case people are interested in it. It's on space.com and it says James Webb Space Telescope, the scientific observatory, or no other observatory could unravel. It's published December 24th, 2021. So this is cool stuff for me anyway. Now here's another subtitle saying Untangling Early Star and Galaxy Formation. It was the Wide Field Camera 3 that opened some of the best views into the early universe. Webb is now positioned to surpass that legacy. So says Kimball, and quote, when it comes to these distant galaxies, the Wide Field Camera 3 runs out of wavelengths. Some of those detections get kind of iffy, and it will be very interesting to see which ones turn out to be right. Webb will be able to do that kind of thing, to say exactly that we see this particular galaxy 250 million years after the Big Bang, end quote. Hubble, McCaughrean says, can see up to 13 billion years into the past, and already sees galaxies that by that moment in their evolution may have formed several generations of stars. If we see that material somehow 500 million years after the Big Bang, it must have been made even earlier by stars we haven't yet seen. Big stars form and die quickly in only a few million years, so after 500 million years, you may have had lots of generations of massive stars. Okay, and here's what's it called? A light cone or something that shows the first 100 million years after the Big Bang. So there's some kind of weird cone. I know physicists have seen it. Inflation, quantum fluctuation. First stars, about 400 million years. The chemical evolution of the universe. Olivia Jones, a scientist at the Royal Observatory, Edinburgh, is most interested in what happens when these early stars die, releasing their material into the surroundings to give birth to new stars. Astronomers know that the early universe had a very different chemical composition from what we see today. It consisted only of hydrogen, helium, and a bit of lithium, Jones told space.com. All the other chemical elements that we see now, including those that make life possible, were cooked up throughout eons inside those stars. So says Jones, and quote, a lot of the chemical synthesis in the universe is around massive stars when they explode, or low-mass stars in their final stages of evolution. There's lots of interesting slow-process chemistry that can happen in their atmospheres because of the temperatures and pressures. And it's just fascinating to me how we can go from having only three chemical elements to the vast array of diversity we see around us today, end quote. The spectroscopes aboard James Webb will be able to probe the chemical kitchens of those early galaxies, seeing what was cooking inside individual stars and what they fertilized the wider cosmos with when they exploded in powerful supernovas. Now here's another subsection. Why don't I go for a break now, and then I will read this subsection. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I'm reading through an article that is very long but very interesting. It's about the James Webb Telescope, and the title is James Webb Space Telescope, the Scientific Mysteries No Other Observatory Could Unravel. And this was published by Teresa Poltrarova, December 24th, 2021. Okay, so here's a subtitle. subtitle says Peering Through Dust into the Hearts of Star-Forming Regions. While Webb and Hubble are frequently compared, their images will be quite different, revealing different aspects of the universe. While Hubble's strength is imaging the visible universe, Webb's infrared superpowers will enable it to see through dust right into the heart of nebulas, galaxies, and star-forming regions that are hidden from Hubble's view. So says Cogrian again, in quote, we know that stars are being born in places like the Orion Nebula and other nebula in the sky, but we couldn't see into them in optical because optical light gets absorbed by dust. Previously, when we could see the site of star formation, we would see multiple objects all mushed in together. Webb will be able to separate them all out individually. We would be able to see multiple stars being born in clusters, where previously we could only detect those clusters, end quote. Now, it's not cool. It's nice that they're specifying this stuff. I guess every time I do a show, I learn, don't I? Previous infrared observatories, such as Spitzer, were much smaller than Webb. Therefore, they couldn't see as far as Webb, and when they did, they only glimpsed those stars, star-forming regions, in a limited resolution. Well, astronomers have been able to map star formation in our own galaxy, the Milky Way. The James Webb Space Telescope will rip open starburst centers in farther away reaches of the universe. So said Jones again, in quote, we will see the more distant, more extreme galaxies where the environmental conditions are very different from what we can see in the Milky Way. Previously, we could only see stars about 8 times the mass of the Sun, but now we should be able to see the formation of stars about as big as the Sun, and that process has never been observed before. So now it says outer solar system. But it will not all be about faraway places. Scientists interested in Earth's more local neighborhood will also have their fun with WAVE. With James Webb, we can't look inwards towards the Sun, but we will be able to look outwards. We can look at planets like Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, but also into the Kuiper Belt. The Kuiper Belt is a repository of comets, asteroids, and other debris that encircles the outer solar system beyond the orbit of Neptune. It's a dark and cold region that is very difficult to explore because these objects reflect very little light. So says McKeegan again, in quote, James Webb can do fantastic spectroscopy on Kuiper Belt objects. These objects are really cold, they don't reflect much light, so you need a big infrared telescope. We know that these have ices and various molecules on their surfaces, and we hope to be able to see that, end quote. So this all makes me very exciting, learning more about Webb. Now here's another subtitle called Exoplanets. Just like with Hubble, science has moved forward since the conception of Webb, and new areas have emerged that may not have been foreseen when the first light machine was conceived. In 1995, the first two planets orbiting another star than our Sun were discovered. Since then, thousands of exoplanets of various sizes and kinds have been detected, and while not designed with these potential other Earths in mind, the James Webb Space Telescope turns out to be positioned to not only discover many more, but also to tell us much finer details about their nature than any other mission before. These planets have atmospheres that have various molecules in them, things like carbon dioxide, oxygen, and nitrogen. And to look at these molecules, that's really best done with infrared spectroscopy, end quote. I can remember my first year in UBC, 1976, when I took chemistry, first year chemistry, we did a spectroscopy experiment. It was very interesting, lots of fun. One of Webb's instruments, the near-infrared camera, NIRCam, is fitted with extra implements called coronagraphs, which block out the light of a star to see more directly what is happening around it. That indeed might involve alien systems of planets, some of which might be habitable with water and atmosphere that could support life just like Earth. So says Kimball, in quote, 30 years ago, no one would have imagined that we could study the composition of atmosphere of planets around other stars. Now we are doing it routinely, and Webb is going to do that much better, end quote. Now there's a subsection here called the Great Unknowns. Webb was built to revolutionize astronomy. 10 years from now, many of its most groundbreaking discoveries may have come from realms that are still completely unknown today. So says Kimball again, and quote, lots of quotes in this article. What is so exciting about Hubble and Webb is that they are general purpose observatories. They had some specific key science goals, but they have a broad range of capabilities that enable them to make discoveries that were not in the areas that you have designed the telescopes for. If you do Hubble's top 10's greatest hits, half of them were things they knew they were building it for, and half of them were things that people had no idea about, like dark energy and exoplanet studies. I hope the same thing will be true about Webb, end quote. Now that is very exciting. It will be. The James Webb Space Telescope will change our view of the universe, said Jones, and it's only thanks to people who thought about it when I was only maybe at primary school that people like me can now make the most of it at this stage in our career, end quote. It will be young astronomers such as Jones, who was only a little girl when the James Webb Space Telescope was conceived, who will be unraveling those great unknowns for decades to come. So who could have imagined a little girl, 5 years old, someone comes up to them and reads their future and says, you are going to be an astrophysicist working with the most advanced telescope or machine ever conceived by people. And she'd go, where's my dolly? Okay, so, or a little boy, you go up to a little boy and you say, you're going to be an astrophysicist. And he says, like Spider-Man? Where's my truck? James Webb Space Telescope instruments. So here, it went over the instruments, which I went over in the video I played earlier. It's called Near Infrared CAM. It will be crucial for accomplishing Webb's flagship goal, detecting the light from the earliest stars and galaxies. The Near Infrared Spectrograph, NIRSPEC, the main tool for cracking the chemistry of the universe. It will split the light coming from the distant universe into spectra, revealing the properties of the observed objects, including their temperature, mass, and chemical composition. It basically lets you open the little doors and let the light through from one galaxy, but then block off all the light from everything else. The mid-infrared instrument, or MIRI. MIRI is a combo of a camera and a spectrograph, but unlike the previous two, it observes in the longer wavelengths of the mid-infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which will make it a go-to instrument for everyone looking to study everything from comets and asteroids at the outskirts of our solar system to newly born stars and distant galaxies. The images of MIRI will be the most akin to those that turned the Hubble Space Telescope into a legend. And the fine guidance system, or sorry, the fine guidance sensor, near infrared imager, and slitless spectrograph, FGS/NIRISS, will also contribute to the detection of the first light, spot exoplanets, and analyze their chemistry. Okay, so follow Teresa Paltarova on Twitter at Teresa.